Welcome back to the Pod of Greed.
Welcome back indeed, guys, to the one
and only
podcast on the internet. Today we have a smorgasbord of stories.
That's right. We have delectable delights like Yu-Gi-Oh. Paul's thoughts on the Epstein case.
Oh, I was going to say and Yu-Gi-Oh, but that too.
Mostly the Yu-Gi-Oh. The Epstein thing is just Paul's hobby.
Right. Either way, happy Thursday. Hopefully you guys are having a good one. Lots to talk about, but before we get into all of it, we do need you guys to do us a little quick favor.
Put your ones up.
Yes, ones in the chat if you're watching the premiere, and also do us a favor and like the video.
And makes comment.
They'll share it to more people on YouTube and all that. Yeah, and if you're watching after the premiere, then commenting is also helpful.
They can comment during the premiere as well.
You can do that, but then that'd be in the chat. You can do both.
You can do, why not do just both? Do everything. You got time. You're watching a podcast. I mean, the podcast.
Not a podcast. Yeah.
The podcast.
I want to start real quick, actually, by shouting out all the people that I met at the Yu-Gi-Oh! NAWCQ, which is such a long acronym now that I'm like saying it out loud.
Just call it NATS.
Yeah, Yu-Gi-Oh! NATS this past weekend in Indianapolis. It was a really cool event. I was actually only there on Sunday because I woke up Saturday and felt antisocial.
So, and I woke up for the entire weekend and felt antisocial, and that's why I wasn't there. No, that's not true. I had a family thing. I apologize.
Yeah, I did meet a lot of people there. That was really cool. I got to see the finals live on Sunday, which was nice. And
well, of course you did because you played in it.
Yeah, I was there on the stage.
That's right.
That was me.
And then you won the entire event.
Shoutouts to the actual winner of the event, Wilfredo Flores.
Congrats. Wait, what'd they play?
He won with Fiendsmith Orcist, which is kind of interesting.
I'll allow that. All right, congrats.
Although the top 64 was quite diverse, there were lots of things, lots of Malice, lots of Mitsurugi. That has been a big deck in the format, I'm told. Actually, the third most popular deck in the top 64 was my personal precious babies, the Vanquish Souls.
Third most popular. They get, what, three new cards and all of a sudden
I know.
Heavy hitter in the format?
It'll do that. Also, some unexpected ones like Gem Knights managed to make their way in, and there was like a Goblin Biker deck that made it in, an Evil Twin deck, so.
Okay, so this is the full like competitive gamut of things. You had meta, you had anti-meta, you had kind of off-the-wall picks.
Off-the-wall stuff.
I like that.
2,819 duelists, 12 rounds of Swiss, and a cut to top 64. So this was actually a really, really big event.
That's a whole lot of Yu-Gi-Oh.
I know, it's a lot. And I was at the venue, and even just the venue was huge. Like it felt like this was like the Yu-Gi-Oh! Mecca. And I guess it should be. It's Nationals.
And it makes sense. It was in Indianapolis, and there's nothing else in that city, so it might as well have the biggest Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournament.
That's true. It's like number 16 most boring cities or something in the United States.
Guys, if you were at Nats, tell us what you did other than play Yu-Gi-Oh! Because I'm genuinely curious if there's anything to do in that city.
Yeah, I was getting some dinner with some people afterwards, and we were kind of remarking on how, like, all the places to eat were just generic chains, and there's no, like, personality to the place. But anyway, cool event. Met people. It was awesome. The people want to meet you, Alec, though, so you got to make sure you get to the next
thing. Will get to Worlds if Konami flies me out.
Well, I don't think you'll meet too many of them at Worlds. Konami doesn't even want the players going to that.
We have fans all over the world.
Well, right, but like they don't want to let spectators go.
I thought it was only in the US. I thought they could.
Yeah, it might be different over there. I'm not really sure.
Where is the next Worlds?
It's Paris.
Oh, Paris. Paris.
First, let's talk about some Yu-Gi-Oh! Products that were announced. Something that we kind of missed last week because of when we recorded the podcast and all is this new Chronicles structure deck that was announced.
Yeah.
So it's going to be released on October 24th, actually, and the same day as the product in the OCG. So this is going to be a...
Which is very strange.
Like maybe the first joint TCG-OCG release ever in a long time, as far as I know.
I can't think of a time when that's ever happened.
So here's what they've got to say. Enjoy the ongoing animated series even more with the Chronicles deck, the Fallen and the Virtuous, all foil edition.
Ooh.
Have you been watching Yu-Gi-Oh! Card game, The Chronicles? A new episode of these animated shorts is released every month, telling the stories of the monsters behind the cards set in their own worlds. The story, running from June through November, is The Fallen and the Virtuous. Which, that's interesting. I guess that means that we're getting like five episodes of that.
I have no problem with that.
Five or six or something. I thought we were only getting three, so it sounds like it's more. telling the tales of Fallen Valbaz and Dogmatica Ecclesia. Well, anyway, this 51-card all-foil deck includes the key characters, places, and situations seen in the animated shorts in their original monster spell and trap forms. And it comes with two brand new cards never before seen, four new variant arts of some old favorites, and foil versions of the most popular cards centered around Fallen Valbaz that duelists have woven into their decks these last 5 years. So the main deck and extra deck combined are 50 ultra-rare cards, and the 51st card in each deck is a secret rare repeat of one of the deck's ultra-rare cards, but with a bonus chance to upgrade to Starlight Rare instead.
Yeah, we got a little chase rarity action here.
Similar to the Blue Eyes White Destiny structure deck. So yeah, 50 ultras, one secret, and a second copy of one of the... Or it's a second copy of one of the six ultra-rare cards with a small chance of being Starlight.
This product is groundbreaking in a couple ways, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a few neat things here.
Because like we already said, this is the first simultaneous release product that we know of. We could be wrong, but I can't think of another. But this is definitely our first like structure deck that's all foil.
Yeah, there's a few things. There's that. It's an OCG-TCG like simultaneous release. I don't think we've had an all-foil structure before, not that I know of, and I think that's a pretty cool development in its own right, just because like it's kind of supposed to be going alongside the anime, or animated shorts. Maybe calling it an anime is a bit much, but what do you think? I mean, I guess like this is sort of what you and I have talked about, where it's like it's cool to have these animated shorts, but they kind of need to be released alongside products too, so that there's like a conversion there.
I think, while not perfect, because you know the time of Fallen of Valbaz and the TCG has kind of fallen off, so there is a little less hype for it.
Mm-hmm.
This is like when it comes to Konami, you gotta kind of give them some wiggle room here. But this is pretty good. This is pretty good.
They said there are two new cards. There will be something that we haven't seen.
New cards, new rarities, new artworks, all in one product. It's so close to being like everything we've been talking about for the last couple years.
And released alongside the anime. So that's or animated shorts. So that's good. Like, I was afraid there was going to be one of these things where, like, yeah, the shorts come out and then, like, this structure releases, like, 6 months after the end of the... You know, Konami sometimes will just mess up the timeline with stuff like that.
So I feel like I'd be a hypocrite to be critical of a product like this when it is, while not perfectly everything I've wanted in a Yu-Gi-Oh! Product, it tries to be a perfect Yu-Gi-Oh! Product. Now, do they sell us what the MSRP of it is? I don't think so.
Right? I don't think it was mentioned.
Because that price could be a deal breaker.
I could definitely see this being a little bit more expensive than the average structure deck. Because, like, normally structures right now, I think, are like $11.99 or $12, basically. I could see this being something closer to like $20. Maybe even $25 or something like that.
I could see $25. I think my limit is $29.99 for the average person. If it starts in the 30s, I feel I'll still get it. So I don't know. It's hard for me to even be critical because I'm going to get it. As long as it's not like a $100 product, I'm going to get it.
I like that it's also like, I mean, I think that easily branded has been the most popular of all the lore stories Yu-Gi-Oh's ever done. Like, I think the most amount of people have gotten into that. So cool. I mean, and Master Duel also.
Combination, right? It's, it was the last of the long lore stories.
Yeah, true. Because Diabella Stars ended kind of in only like 8 sets. And Visa Starfrost was only like an 8-set thing, or like a 6-set thing or something. So
it was meta relevant throughout its entire run of cards. Like, Branded really, they did the thing.
Yeah. And that's not the only structure deck, actually, if you can believe it.
Yes.
So normally I'm on here complaining about how there aren't enough Yu-Gi-Oh! Structure decks. Well, they're kind of doing the next one a little bit differently. So we talked about how there is the structure deck in the OCG Power of Fellows, which was the Yusei, like, Junk Synchron-based structure deck. Well, what we got announced for the TCG is Legendary 5Ds decks, the TCG Collector's Set.
We're bringing back the Legendary decks?
Yeah, we're bringing them back.
I thought they died.
They did. I mean, for a long time. If you guys remember, those were the three decks in one box thing. Mm-hmm. I think the first one was Yugi's Legendary Decks, which was actually just three variations of Yugi's decks. Then there was the Legendary Decks 2, which was Yugi, Kaiba, and Joey got a deck. And then the third one was Legendary Dragon Decks.
Wait, which one was Legendary Heroes Decks?
That might have been two.
That might have been a second one.
Yeah. Either way, yeah, they did that for a few years. And those were different because basically for $30, you got three fully built decks. I say fully built, mostly built.
Mostly built.
They were cool. They would like include new support and all that.
They made it easy for us to shoot content.
Yeah, and this will too, because Legendary 5D's decks contains three complete ready-to-play decks with 50 cards each, 5 Ultras, 45 Commons per deck. So you get a Yusei deck with 8 brand new cards never released before.
Okay.
This we know will be just the one-to-one kind of thing with the OCG product. A second Signer's deck. Check back in a couple of weeks for the identity of this mysterious duelist. And a third Signer's deck. Also a mystery, at least for now, but we'll tell you soon. So each deck has Each has a 40-card main deck and a 10-card extra deck, plus a bonus, see below. The bonus being that there are 3 secret rare chibi token cards and 3 secret rare chibi variant art monster cards. So, like, for instance, what they show here is a chibi art Stardust Dragon and a Yusei.
So we might be able to figure out the other signers. Because, like, those chibi arts, those have existed for a while, right?
Yeah, I think that these are all from that game Duel Arena.
Because I know Red Dragon has chibi art, so it feels... It stands to reason that Red Dragon is going to be one of them. And I can't think of who else has chibi art.
Now, here's something else they say. Make no mistake, these decks contain some of the most popular card tech. From Molcharmy Meowls to Infinite Impermanence, they can go into any deck that you're playing. So they're going to be having reprints.
Molcharmy's in there?
At least Meowls. And and the 5Ds themed cards in each deck aren't one of each samplers, but they come in twos and threes that you'll need to make these decks really
and
work.
And threes?
So this is feeling a little bit more like close to that Tactical Tri vibe.
Yeah, because even the Tactical Tri decks, I don't believe had three of them.
They had three of them.
Did they have? Not Tactical Tri decks, the Legendary decks.
Yeah, those I don't remember.
I don't think they had
some three maybe of those. Did. But these definitely feel like these are like ready to play or closer to ready to play out the box.
I guess we will need to see more to know for a fact, but it does sound more Tactical Tri-like.
Yeah, the special bonus being that each deck's 51st card is a fully playable chibi art version of that signer's main monster. For Yusei's deck, that's a chibi Stardust Dragon. So you'll get 3 playable chibi monster cards total, and you'll also get 3 different token cards. Going fast makes you feel alive, but looking cute also helps you scoot.
They did not. That is not in the official.
That's in the official blurb. Gotta give Konami some credit.
Konami, you're on my list.
Yeah, so I thought this was really cool. It's a different way of releasing a structure deck, and this is coming out on November 7th. Ironically, that's just 2 weeks after the Fallen and the Virtuous deck. So what are we thinking?
We would be the world's most hypocritical podcast and the only podcast if we were to criticize this even slightly, because back to back, they're basically smacking us in the face and telling us to come up with something new to rant about.
Yeah, which I guess there's something new coming up in the podcast this week, but we're not there just yet. I like this. I think objectively this is the right call. This is good, particularly because they are combining both a new structure with general anime fan service of a beloved anime in 5Ds. They're adding in some good reprints, and they're kind of ensuring that even if you don't like the sort of synchron strategy and stuff, there's probably one of these three decks you'll like. Like, no matter what combination of signers it is.
So I feel like it's going to be, you know, Yusei, Jack, and Crow.
The easy guess.
It is easy, but it's easy-ish. Because, you know, like, Luna got support recently. Akiza's a big fan favorite. Like, there are other picks. I just feel like those three are...
I mean, they're the easiest to market.
They're the most solid.
I was going to say, too, is so Luna got support in the last set.
Yep.
But also, Akiza is getting support in Doom of Dimensions. There's supposed to be some...
There's like Rose,
like Rose Dragon stuff in there, I think.
I didn't even see.
If I'm remembering. And so they probably wouldn't... They would, in order to make an Akiza deck, they'd have to include cards from Doom of Dimensions. But like it'll be coming out around that time. So like you wouldn't want to double up, you know,
then again, your Konami. It could be a chance to get the old Rose Dragon cards out there so that you can just upgrade.
With the new stuff?
Yeah.
But then that kind of ruins the premise of, like, you and friends playing with these
out
of the box.
It does damage the vibe. It would be the weakest deck out of the box until you get the new support.
I guess my money just on, like, Jack and Crow, just to be easy.
Those were Yusei's fellows.
Either way, this is $31.99. So, basically the price of, like, what three structures would be, roughly.
I'm not mad at it.
I like it. Thumbs up, Konami. I think this is really cool. All right, now to get into the more controversial stuff.
I'm taking off my Konami shell hat.
Yeah, so as you guys might know, here's a little quick catch-up. About a month ago, Konami changed the rule set around the Time Wizard formats that they run at events like YCS Nationals. Previously, you were able to play an old format, like let's say Edison or GOAT, with those old cards as their old texts were written, with old rulings and all of that.
As God intended.
Yeah. Then, though, Konami said, okay, you guys actually are going to use the new updated texts of all these cards with, like, problem-solving card text, which changes the functionality of several cards, updated rules, because certain the way that certain chains and stuff would resolve, or, like, ignition effect priority, that would be gone, too. And also, cards that got errated, like Brain Control, Goyo Guardian, Crush Card Virus, Ring of Destruction, all those cards for those old formats would also have, like, their updated revised text.
And that's how the Egyptian gods intended.
Right. And so that, you know, fundamentally changes how those old formats would be played. And that's what they were going to do for public events at Nationals.
Mm-hmm.
People were furious. We discussed it on this podcast.
People were running about.
Yeah. And they complained, made a fuss, rightfully so. And so Konami heard, and at least for Nationals, they seemingly changed that.
The way the creator intended.
Here's the thing, though. Nationals passed, and now there have been some documents that have come out from Tier 2 local stores saying that they're going to be phasing out Time Wizard or else risk losing their OTS status. So,
why is it got to be a sound like a threat?
I mean, I guess presumably it is. So this came from Epic Cards and Games. They say, hello, duelists. According to Konami's official operations document for Tier 2 events, the Time Wizard format is no longer recognized as an official tournament format as of July 10th. It's been replaced with the new Time Travel format for Tier 2 and up events. As a result, we're updating our weekly tournament schedule effective Wednesday as follows. And so they kind of have their weekly schedule of like stuff that's on like Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, whatever. And they are going to be running Time Wizard Edison until Time Wizard is fully phased out by the Konami official page. Same with GOAT, and after that, there will not be any more of it. So apparently there has been a document going out to OTS stores saying that, yes, Time Wizard is being phased out. If you want to run official OTS tournaments and like give, you know, OTS packs or something as prize support, you'll get support for Konami. You cannot do that anymore. That's the story.
Okay, so I already hear... So now read the title of that to me one more time. Like the title of the post.
But this is from Epic Cards and Games. It's hello, duelists. According to Konami's official operations document for Tier 2 events, the Time Wizard format is no longer recognized as an official tournament.
Oh, I meant the threat. The threat.
Oh. So the threat is not explicitly written. That comes from a tweet from
E3 Yu-Gi-Oh. All right, because what you read is not what that threat was.
Yeah,
because
presumably not.
This made it, the threat makes it sound like there will be consequences if you run Time Wizard events anymore. But it's not that you can't run Time Wizard events. It's actually that they're phasing out officially supporting Time Wizard.
Yeah.
And like replacing it with, what do we call this format now?
Time Traveler.
Time Traveler. It does not roll off the tongue as easily.
Here's what I've heard people saying.
Okay. What are the people saying?
So basically, people are very upset because this feels as though they're rug pulling us. They made a change. People did not like the change.
Yep.
Konami seemed to walk back the change. Mm-hmm. But now that Nationals is over, they have gone back on that. And they're continuing with their phasing out of Time Wizard as we knew it.
Right.
You will now be playing Time Traveler, which is old card pool, but new card text and rules. And also, it is putting shops sort of in a bit of a difficult position because if a shop wants to maintain its OTS status, then it has to run time traveler events, at least in an official capacity. And that is difficult because some shops are, I guess, running Edison and Goat as is. They had an established community that really liked it, and they won't be able to do that anymore.
I know players are very upset about this, but I actually kind of feel bad, or maybe worse, for like tournament organizers for card shops, because like for the individual player it can suck, but players can kind of move around and do what they want on the individual like person by person basis. But if you have a community that you have built and cherished,
yeah,
this is a
as
huge
a card shop or
an
organizer, that really sucks. By the way, if you guys hear like wind and stuff, it's because it's kind of storming outside, but there's not really much we can do about that, so hopefully
we can't control the weather.
We'll pod through it anyway though. Yeah, so like I have thoughts and I don't know really where to start. I think it would
I want to say that I think Konami has handled the Time Wizard debacle in maybe not the worst way, but one of the worst ways they could have. I don't know if it ever should have been necessary to announce changes, announce like not reversing those changes, and then to like, they haven't really announced these changes yet, but they will announce changes again. That's just like jerky and confusing. There had to have been
a more
straightforward way to do this.
Yeah, I think it does feel like players are probably feeling like they're getting yanked around a bit, and card shops as well. I think also though, the difficult part here is that like it is fundamentally showing that Konami no longer wants to support things like Edison and Goat in the way that players were playing them previously. And that's something that we were having to contend with about a month ago, and the conversation is just back. Like, do you think that these old formats, the way that they were being played by people, were okay, like as is? Or do you think that Konami is like within their right to update them? Unfortunately, I was thinking about this because, you know, this has happened a couple days ago. And so I tried to like sleep on it and really gather my thoughts. And I basically just landed on this. And it's going to sound kind of shitty at the start, but just bear with me and feel
free
to
interrupt. Which means they're only going to hear the shitty at the start part. And then
yeah, they're going to hear the shitty part, complain, say I'm being a shill or something. Time Wizard is Konami's creation, actually. And what I mean by that is the label of Time Wizard, like they made the Time Wizard designation.
Right.
And that means that if you're playing Time Wizard, you're always going to be at the mercy of Konami's decision-making, any changes. There are benefits to that, and there are detriments to that. So, for instance, being able to play Ultimate Time Wizard at a YCS event and win a giant card or win a mat was always really cool, and that's kind of the benefit of, like, playing it under the official Konami banner at a YCS. On the other hand, though, it means that when they suddenly want to make changes like this, you kind of, like, gotta put up or
gotta
shut
roll
up.
Roll with those punches.
And I also think that players who feel like, how to put this?
He said, stop whining. No.
No, no. Konami doesn't owe anybody anything. They actually don't owe you like some sort of right or entitlement to let you play old formats and them give you support for them. Right?
Right.
Like, they just don't. Here's the good news, though. This might have been one of the best possible things that could have happened. Because by basically drawing that divide here and now, they're letting people know that you, like, because this is the hard lesson that I think a lot of players aren't seeing here. And I think I've kind of learned it years ago just from my own personal dealings with Konami or with like different card shops and stuff. If you want something to happen, you got to take the initiative and do it yourself. The moment that you rely on a large company to like control and handle your fun format, they will always let you down. That's not just a Konami thing. I mean, Magic the Gathering's had really similar issues in the past, haven't they, with like Commander?
I mean, Commander was a fan-made and fan-run format until, well, Wizards took the reins.
Yeah, and some people like the Wizards took the reins because it means that they've released, like, product for Commander.
We get pre-cons now. We get cards designed for the format.
And they kind of do some marketing for Commander. And that's similar to how, like, there are Ultimate Time Wizard events and there's, like, giant cards and there's mats and stuff. But conversely, it means that, like, when Wizards wants to release a Commander ban list, you know, we saw how that went over last year where people were pissed. They're like, what? Like, this is stupid. I'm not following this ban list. I'm going to do my own thing. That was what they were saying. Like, that's what players were saying. I think that this is kind of going to be the same thing where, like, if you want to keep playing Goat and Edison, it's going to just become a purely grassroots thing.
But I guess, you know, speaking for another side here, mm-hmm. and it's, remember, I'm speaking from a different perspective. It doesn't mean it's necessarily my exact opinion, but just throwing this out there. But Konami kind of, like, bulldozed these retro formats a bit because Konami saw that people were having fun playing retro formats and they did not need Konami to help them do it. Yeah. Konami's like, ooh, let's get in on that. So now we're going to offer, like, a way to play retro, but on our, but, like, it's cool, right? You know, you can keep playing what you've been playing and now you can get prize support. Okay, yeah, now that you guys started playing, we're changing the rules now, and it can only be played this one way, and if you want prizing, you have to play our way and not your way now.
It's a rug pull.
And this, but the issue that comes out of it is you had a community of people who were united in their one way of playing their retro formats. Konami pushed their way into that, and then divided and took market share. They just, because some retro players will continue to play the pure Time Wizard format, and some will go on to play the Time Traveler format. Regardless,
there's division there.
Yeah, there's division. Now there'll be confusion when you're holding your Time Wizard tournaments. People that play Time Travel are going to show up and be confused, and vice versa. And that's purely because Konami said, you guys are having too much fun without, like, cutting us into the deal.
Where I think that this definitely, I think that this decision almost 99% came from overseas. I think Konami Japan said, no, we cannot monetize this, and we don't want these people playing this, like, old fun format and getting our prize support from it. Mm-hmm. I think that the only way Konami Japan was ever going to be okay with it is if there was a way to force players to buy new cards, force players to fit within the vision and image of the game that they want it to be. And it's easy to be mad at that, and I don't, and this is my personal opinion here, I think that they didn't handle this well because there was just no community contact or communication in the picture at all.
Right.
But their vision for it, I think, is that, like, listen, if you're going to play Yu-Gi-Oh, you're going to play, like, Yu-Gi-Oh our way and in a way that allows us to sell you cards. It's difficult to monetize Edison players or GOAT players because, for the most part, they have the cards they need. Like, it's a snapshot format, so Edison players will have their Edison decks. And even if you are able to maybe sell them reprints of Edison cards or something like that, they will eventually just get exactly all that they need.
And that's that.
And there would just never be anything new.
Because the card pool can increase.
Yeah, the card pool's not changing. I'm just explaining this. I'm not saying this is a good or bad. I'm just explaining it. That's how it works. And so Konami knows that with the modern format, that, by the way, got nearly 3,000 people this past weekend playing at Nationals, you know, having to buy new cards and new decks that are constantly changing, that's who they want. They want customers. It's like a business thing. And so they saw that Edison's just not making them any money. Some things that I've heard people say is like, well, Edison players do bring in money. But I honestly would say, how? Like, I don't know that Edison players really are putting money in Konami's pocket.
Because, I mean, like, guys, you know, our Edison, our retro Time Wizard player base, do you buy sealed product? I know that they have these reprint, like, sections of, like, certain sets now. The rarity collections,
yeah.
Did you buy, like, a case of that set because of the retro reprints? Was that enticing enough for you to put money in Konami's pocket?
It's tricky, too, because a lot of people who play Edison play it because they are, you know, they're poor? They play it because, well, maybe, but they play it because they are burnt out of the modern game.
Oh, yeah.
Modern Yu-Gi-Oh! Is overwhelming, and it's not necessarily attractive to everybody, and so Edison offers you a way to play the game at a simpler time, a slower pace. Right. Thing is, though, like, would you ever have changed to the modern game? And I think Konami deemed the answer to that to be no. That, like...
It does make sense, because you're right. These retro snapshot formats are so different from the modern game. It's unlikely someone playing those formats would find a lot of appeal in the modern game.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have said as much. Like, a lot of people that I've spoken to who play Edison are just like, yeah, I play it because, like, it's fun and I do not like modern Yu-Gi-Oh! And as we know, modern Yu-Gi-Oh! Isn't slowing down anytime soon.
No, we get
faster. It only speeds up. And so I think Konami just sort of made the executive call that, like, these Edison players cannot be monetized. So we're going to make them play Time Traveler format, where they are more incentivized to have to buy the Rarity Stampede and Rarity, whatever the other one, Bonanza,
yeah,
that have, like, the reprints and the retro,
oh,
you know.
Oh, God, Paul. I just had the sickest thought. I really hope Konami doesn't do this.
Uh-oh, what?
So Konami could, because of the rules of Time Traveler, they could start giving erratas to old,
to more and more
staples, yeah, in those older formats. And because of the rules, you have to use the updated text of those cards.
Yeah, and who's to say they won't?
Oh, that is sick.
Now,
that is, I hope they don't do that.
So up to now, I have been sort of sympathizing with the perspective that Konami likely had in this decision.
Corporate shill.
And so, yeah, exactly. I'm a corporate shill. You're angry at me. You're saying, Paul, you don't understand, right? Here is why I say all of that could actually be a good thing. And I sort of mentioned it before. This means that this is just concrete proof that you should not, like, ever rely on a company like Konami to run a format that was player made. Don't, mm-hmm, like, do not let them dictate your fun. Konami cannot control your ability to play Edison. And here's the proof. They did the RBET tournament this past weekend at Nationals.
The what?
Really Big Edison Tournament. Okay. Yes, that's what it stands for. I don't know who came up with it, but it's, that was a thing that they did in Indianapolis at a separate venue, and they said over 500 people showed up and played. So it was a really big success. To me, that's proof that you guys who play Edison, because I don't actually play Edison, so I don't have, like, a huge dog in the fight, but, like, for people who enjoy Edison, there's your answer. Like, don't play Konami's thing. You know, really do, and I truly mean this, vote, like, with your wallet. Vote with your attendance.
Right.
Instead of just screaming at them to change it, they won't. You know, just go to these RBET tournaments and, like, go support whatever, like, local grassroots Edison things that there are. Konami cannot, like, come into your house, knock your door down, and, like, yank your Edison cards away from you unless they pull a Wizards of the Coast and call the Pinkertons.
Like, Wizards is like, nah, we can find you.
Yeah, but generally speaking, you know, like, Jerome's not going to be, like, knocking at your door telling you can't play Edison at your kitchen table. Dope, yeah, Jerome's not going to come to your door and tell you cannot play Edison, right? Like, you can play it at your kitchen table. You can play it at your card shop. The thing is, even these, like, policies, all they're saying is that an OTS shop cannot, like, officially host Yu-Gi-Oh! Tournaments that, like, use the Konami tournament software and give out, like, yeah, you know, OTS packs and stuff.
But your shop can actually still host Edison.
Yeah, your shop can do whatever they want to do. Konami can't dictate that. And that's the solution there, is, like, don't bet. Like, it's kind of weird. People are angry at Konami. They're kind of, like, begging for this weird compromise. But if you're begging a corporation for a compromise, you probably need to be a little concerned, because that means that anything that you get will be temporary at best. Like, that's kind of what the last situation proved to us.
But we have this issue where we are a player base that's so devoid of attention and love from our parent Konami, that when we finally got it,
it felt good.
It felt so good, and then it got ripped away. We want it back. Look at me. I'm here.
Yeah, recognize the middle child or whatever.
But that they've always been a neglectful parent. I don't know why anyone would think they just suddenly changed.
It very much can feel like an abusive relationship, where you kind of get the push and pulls of attention at times, and then other times you don't, and, like, you kind of beg for it back and you never quite leave. To me, this is, like, maybe the symbol or the signal or whatever. Like, leave. Don't let Konami dictate what don't your favorite
hit you again.
Format, what your favorite format is. You know, like it, that's difficult to hear because it does mean that there are things that are lost in that process. It means that now the only way to get a oversized or giant card is by playing Time Traveler or getting like a cool Edison themed mat.
You hop on eBay and you crack that wallet open.
And to be fair, I mean, there's going to be people who will fill this vacuum that will be left, right?
That's true. If there's prizing to be won, I promise you there's a Yu-Gi-Oh player ready to fill whatever that hole is.
Yeah, so like I think
that phrasing wasn't perfect.
We just can't take anything seriously around here. Yeah, so, you know, I guess we just shouldn't be surprised that this eventually would happen. And I don't think that, I guess what I want people to take away from this is the news sucks, but you don't want to go crawling back to your abuser asking for, like, things back because that just gives them power over you. Maybe that's, like, maybe hard, like, just harsh language, but, like, support RBET. Support online, like, Edison Discords and tournaments and stuff. And go to your local shop and just play Edison with people. You can still do that.
That's right.
Like, Konami can't, like, stop you from doing that. Don't worry about whether or not they're going to have an ultimate time wizard that you want, like, with the rules you want at the next YCS. Then just don't go.
Or you just play both.
Or that.
I guess, technically, you could just play both. The card pool is still exactly the same. There will be some rule differences, but
that's what I was
gonna say. Have your fun with like a proper Edison tournament and then go and try and win a giant card.
That's the thing. I think there's going to be people who do both or do only one, like, or only do the new Time Traveler thing. Like, I don't think this is objectively bad. I think optically, Konami could have handled it a lot better. But then I remembered, though, what would you even say to, like, even if they did make a statement, what would you say? Sorry, guys, you're not making us enough money, so we're changing things.
Well, I don't think they have to give us an explanation. Just have said in no uncertain terms what is happening, and the ruling is final. There will not be a wishy-washy reversal on this.
I think something that did rub people the wrong way was that it seemed like they were kind of like sending shops these threatening emails, but not just outright saying it. I still think that, like, I think the jury's still out. Like, they might still just make a proper statement in the next week or two because they always send OTS tournaments, like, these emails about changes in advance of the changes happening because they're OTS stores. So I would hold out and, like, see if Konami chooses to say anything. Mm-hmm. Don't hold your breath too much. Like, it's, you know, it's Konami. We know how they roll. But, again, it's just kind of like the parting of ways. If you like Edison, you can still play Edison exactly as you wanted to. And people were playing Edison even before Konami started doing Ultimate Time Wizard.
That's true. They were already not playing for giant cards and playmats. So
yeah. So what happened to that passion,
it's
right?
It's a return, like, to form.
And I think that kind of brings me to my last little small hot take about this. And the whole, like, asking for Konami to change it back thing is,
stop whining.
Stop giving them, like, power over you, you know? Like, I'm serious, though. Like, it's, I think if you really like Edison, nothing's actually changing for you.
That's true. It's a never-ending format. A never-changing format. Konami's rules be damned.
So that's my stance on it. I mean, what about you? I know I talked a lot. Sorry.
I feel like, you know, we kind of like covered the whole thing. My opinion is that I think Konami handled this poorly.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. I think that the yanking people around sucked.
I think a statement
would be good.
Being angry and then cheering and then being angry again. Like, nobody likes that. Like, there had to have been a better way.
Yeah. But also, like, we know how Konami rolls. With Japan, they probably said, like, y'all got to just hurry up and do it. We don't really care how you do it or what you say. You're just going to have to do it.
You know what, Konami? If you want to make things right, you need to send everybody their own giant pot of greed card.
Yeah. That we'll forgive you then.
Then you'll make the card worthless. And then we'll see who really cares about Pot of Greed. Oh, yeah. So last week, I talked about how I ordered a Yu-Gi-Oh! Themed keycap from, what's it called? Not Enigma Crafts. Eminent Crafts.
Eminent Crafts, yeah.
And it hadn't shipped yet as of last week's episode. And I, after the pod, I went online and I checked my invoice, and it's like, it said shipping in like September. So like, okay, so I guess that it hasn't, it's not September yet. I shouldn't expect it. And then almost immediately an email popped up telling me it shipped, and it arrived yesterday. So you guys cannot see this. So even audio listeners, you're not missing out, because even video watchers can't actually see the keycap.
Hold it a little closer to you.
But I'm holding a full-size key, but, you know, very tiny in reality, of Red Eye's Black Dragon kind of sitting atop a red stone on top of a kind of Yu-Gi-Oh-themed Egyptian, like, I guess you might call it like a podium. And this little thing is so incredibly detailed. For the size, it's incredible, and I actually have used it on my keyboard already. It works perfectly fine. I use it as my escape key. I'm actually really glad I have it. It's a cool piece of Yu-Gi-Oh merchandise. If you are on the fence about Eminent Crafts, I will go ahead and shill real quick. They make good stuff.
Yeah, just take some time, I guess.
Yeah, these artisan keycaps, they take a while to ship. But well, I'm a believer.
Well, I also have another neat little Yu-Gi-Oh! Piece of merch. A new interactive plush of Yu-Gi-Oh!'s Time Wizard doubles as the most unreliable alarm clock.
Eh?
So, Kotobukiya has begun accepting pre-orders for a unique interactive plush toy of the monster Time Wizard. Kind of funny, what we're just talking about. From the anime series Yu-Gi-Oh! Duel Monsters. Anyway, though, so here's the catch with the Time Wizard alarm clock.
It's a catch. Wait, does it work?
It has a 50-50 chance of not going off.
Wait.
You get the joke?
Wait. But wait, so it is an actual alarm clock?
Yes, it's an actual alarm clock. It has a removable sound unit that powers its special features. The first function is the alarm one-half mode, which turns the plush into an alarm clock with a chaotic twist. After setting an alarm time, a time roulette sound will play, and when the set time arrives, there's a 50% chance the alarm will successfully go off, accompanied by vibrations. If it fails the coin toss, however, the alarm will not activate at all, perfectly replicating the monster's unreliability.
Oh, hell.
Yeah.
There's somebody who's going to get fired from their job playing around with this thing.
The second function, by the way, is the instant one-half mode, which acts as a quick decision-making tool.
Oh.
So when activated, the plush will play the roulette sound for 30 seconds before outputting either a success or failure sound effect, which lets you allowing users to leave everyday choices up to chance.
I need to get this thing. You know how much I love playing Time Wizard.
Yeah, so if you're the that was your card in Retro Rivals.
I'm a big fan of Time Wizard. I love taking that chance. Oh wow, it actually has a time roulette inside of it.
Yeah. It's really cool. It also can be like worn like with a strap, so like you can wear it around your.
You can wear the Time Wizard.
Yeah, like check this
out. Like a Yu-Gi-Oh! Flavor Flav. Okay, more like not like a necklace, but
yeah, like a sort of hip strap thing. And so,
okay, guys, are you willing to take that chance? I know it's.
I want to know. Would you guys buy that?
A 50-50 on your alarm not going off.
That's Time Wizard. That's how it was for Joey.
That's so, yeah, but that it wasn't dependent. His livelihood wasn't. Oh well, then again, his sister's eye surgery was off.
Yeah, oftentimes those duels were like a lot was at stake. So, and it didn't even always work.
I guess honestly, yeah, if Joey can do it, sure, I can risk my livelihood. Collectibles shop loses over $100,000 worth of Pokemon cards in burglary. So this one was a very high priced. Burglary. This is in Massachusetts, where between $110,000 and $130,000 worth of individual first edition and box Pokemon cards were stolen from a first edition collectibles. Oh, from first edition collectibles, a toy and game shop in New Bedford. Yep. So they were just taking whatever. They got sealed. They got unsealed.
It says a person broke into the store at around 2:30 a.m. local time, shoving the high-priced items inside a backpack before making his escape.
It said, what was stolen? A base set unlimited Green Wings booster box, Neo Revelation unlimited booster box, a BGS 8.5 first edition Shadowless Charizard, a BGS 8.5 Skyridge Crystal Charizard, a PSA 9 Gold Star Charizard, a BGS 9 Gold Star Charizard, a PSA 9 Shadowless Charizard, and a BGS 7.5 first edition Shadowless Blastoise.
Okay, so basically what I'm hearing is this person snatched like some sealed product, but most of the value seems like it was in these graded cards. And some of the sealed stuff too, I guess.
But I mean, you got a bunch of graded Charizards and Blastoises on display. You don't even have to know a lot about Pokemon to know those cards are worth a lot.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of how like we were talking about a story the other week where it's like, if I ran a card shop, I would just not have these cards there. I remember asking people in the comments, and I'll ask again, like, why would you, if you're like a card shop owner, like, why would you have these cards like on display? Like, I would not want people to even know that I have them. Like, it would just need to be something where you privately contact me to maybe look through the high end Pokemon stuff for sale or whatever. But I wouldn't want it to ever be something where like the average person can know. Because the thing is, anytime that like this person that stole from the shop is probably like a regular customer there, or like a somewhat regular customer there. Because that's how they know. Like, they've just seen it. They know where the stuff is located. They've seen it in the glass shelf or whatever.
But, I mean, they stole graded cards. And there's a slight issue with stealing graded cards. In fact, they go into it in the article. They said, please be on the lookout for these stolen items. And they show an image of all the things that were taken. And they included the certification numbers of each of the graded cards because when you grade cards, they each get an individual certification number where that's, while not trackable in like the digital sense, is it's in their systems. They'll know if you try to move this card. You can look this certification number up.
Yeah, they say that the stolen cards have been deactivated on the PSA website. So like, since there is like a number associated with them, they can, on the site, like let people know, okay, these have been stolen. So if you get an offer for a card with the certification number, you'll know that was a stolen card. It's still like missing and people are looking for it.
So the thief would then have to ungrade the cards by breaking them out of the slabs, thereby destroying a lot of the value.
That would remove a lot of the value.
And possibly damaging the cards in the process.
Not worth the trouble if you're a petty thief.
Yeah, like, don't steal graded cards. That's too hard to move. Stick to sealed product and binder stuff, you know, the easy stuff to move. I'm not giving tips on how to steal better. It's just graded cards are an easy way to, like, get caught up.
We'll and just I stop feel you like, now. Anyway, the
I just
next...
feel like this guy's going to get caught for... Oh, wait, this is me giving advice again. Never
don't
mind.
Don't steal Pokemon cards.
Yeah, stop doing it.
Related Pokemon theft story, though. It's civil war as one Pokemon trading card store robs another. This one was an amusing story that comes to us from Japan.
Shops stealing from shops?
We've had stories previously in which shops specializing in trading cards have found themselves the unfortunate victims of robberies, but this one really takes the cake. As reported by Automaton, a 35-year-old Japanese man was arrested on suspicion of robbery on July 9th and is alleged to have stolen 123 items at Knife Point, worth approximately $94,000 from a Pokemon trading card store. The twist? The accused is apparently the owner of his own Pokemon and One Piece-focused trading card shop within the same neighborhood. Although the police didn't disclose such information, the owner of the Target store posted a message on X to confirm that the accused is the manager of a competing store. The post concludes by saying that anybody else involved in the crime should surrender immediately, asking those who might have information to come forward.
So the tweet reads, regarding the robbery incident that occurred at our store on 6/14 following Sakaguchi and Ando, the manager of the neighboring store, Trekka Junkie, Yuji Watanabe has also been arrested as an accomplice in a robbery. They're dropping names. Those still involved should surrender immediately. Thinking you won't get caught is impossible. We will absolutely catch everyone. We welcome any information, no matter how small. Yo, I feel like if you're involved in it, you should feel a little nervous. That was a strongly worded tweet.
Surrender now or prepare to fight.
Oh, they should have included
that. That'd be actually really bad. But I guess there's just some irony in like literally a person who like owns another trading card store stealing from another one. I mean, I guess like maybe it's competition has just gotten that fierce.
I mean, Pokemon is really big money, but if you own a business, we already say you shouldn't be selling Pokemon cards, but in fact, you really shouldn't if you have something to lose to that degree.
Yeah, I just thought it'd be kind of fun to have a little double Pokemon theft story this week. You know how it goes.
Because some weeks we've been light. Well, not this week. We weren't.
There's also a Pokemon TCG Pocket update around trading. I found the story, but I will admit I don't play TCG Pocket. So I don't really know exactly how this works. They said that they have changed some of the currencies and also something along the lines of like a wish list. Can you tell me more about it?
I want to, if I could just get it to actually open. So when I hit the link that you put in our little pocket.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't open that.
It doesn't actually open it. But I can give you guys a summary of what I know.
Okay.
So TCG Pocket's trading feature has been under scrutiny ever since it was first introduced because it was released as a dual currency system where you had to use a currency just to be allowed to trade, and then you had to have a currency to trade, and then you could only trade for certain rarities of cards, and it had to be the exact same rarities of cards. It was a restrictive system. It was time-gated, and it was kind of cash-gated because you couldn't trade cards unless you had a full set of them already. So the system was not well-liked. So they promised to change it, and what they've been doing in the interim is basically dropping as much of that trading currency into our accounts as possible so that we wouldn't complain. And to be fair, I actually haven't run into a problem of running out of that currency, but to be fair, I've also
done maybe three. Is that Shine Dust? Is that what that is?
No.
Or trade tokens?
Trade tokens.
Okay, because I just found their thing on Twitter. They say that They've added a wishlist feature where you can now indicate which cards you'd like to trade for when trading with other players. You can add up to 20 cards to your wishlist from the My Card screen. And you can also select three of your wishlisted cards to display on your profile. That sounds nice.
Because you were kind of playing Russian roulette with getting trades off without using external means of getting trades off the ground.
More importantly, though, trade tokens will be discontinued and you will no longer need to consume cards in order to trade. Instead, Shine Dust will be required to trade. Any three diamond, four diamond, and star rarity cards? Is that like a...
So, the rare... I mentioned earlier that you were limited in what rarities of cards could be traded. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, you could not actually trade star rarity cards at all in the old system. So, I guess now you can trade alt arts, which is cool.
When you obtain a card that's already registered in your card decks, the amount of shine dust that's automatically granted will be increased to double the current amount. You can exchange trade tokens you already have for pack hourglasses and shine dust at the shop.
Ooh, I'm going to get so many hourglasses.
So I guess this just sounds like a nice quality of life thing for the community.
Yeah, I mean, it's long overdue. This system reminds me a lot of a game I played called Guilty Dragon, where essentially you just posted a list of cards you were willing to trade and a list of cards you were looking for. And then people would just browse and they'd see if, oh, do they line up? This guy has the card I want and I have one of the cards they want. We can make a trade.
So, yeah, just cool TCG Pocket news. I didn't find any other card game news, but I saw you got this Gundam thing.
Talk about it. So this past weekend was the release of the Gundam card game starter decks, and there were a series of like starter deck tournaments. And I got one, but this isn't just any Gundam starter deck. Kevin, the camera here. This is the Gundam card game X Gundam Assemble product. So Gundam Assemble is a separate but equal game for Bandai, where it's a tabletop Gundam-style game that can be played on its own, but the pieces can also be used as tokens for the Gundam card game. Now, they have no functional use in the card game except to look cool.
It's, but if you're like a Gundam fan, I guess like that's part of the appeal.
Because they look cool. You're essentially playing, you know, a card game, but with little like representations of your cards. I think it's awesome, and I can't wait. So a Gundam Assemble product has your starter deck, like you'd expect, but then it also comes with the displayed characters or figures at the bottom. And like any good Bandai product, you have to build and paint them yourself because they come in these little grids. And if you ever built a Gunpla model, you're very familiar with how these runners work. You have to kind of poke them out or cut them out. And they come, I think, completely gray. So you get the fun of customizing and painting them yourself. That's fun.
Some people are into that.
So. Some people are into that if you're in the miniatures community or you're near a miniatures community. You know many people who love painting figures, and they can probably help you where you lack. Because while I do own paints and have painted Gunpla before, I don't love doing it. So I will be leaning on my Warhammer crowd to paint mine.
Okay, maybe we can try to open it on the channel, let people see.
That'd be cool. Process. And in case you're wondering what all comes in it, I'd mentioned you do get your ready-to-play starter deck, your Gundam Assemble figures, but you also get one alternate art holographic card. I've been seeing these posted around online. I did not know that was a thing for these products. I think they might even be included in the normal Star decks too. That I'm not 100% sure on. But there are lots of there's lots of alt art holos in this in these starter sets and in the main set that comes out next week. So I'm looking forward to it. Try to pick these up where you can. They retail for like just under 40, but online you will spend double that. So try to find them in person.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's all the card game stuff. So. Oh, yeah, there was the Magic Sonic thing. Were you able to get into the Sonic Secret Layers? How'd that go?
Yes. So the Sonic Secret Layer happened last week, and I almost forgot, but I did get in. And it was actually less painful than the last few Secret Layers I participated in. I think it's purely because I think Wizards just made sure to have more available.
Yeah, it might have been a little bit less anticipated. I feel like the Sonic one was announced kind of close to its release, but maybe that's always like that.
Like it didn't feel too sudden, at least as far as I'm concerned. But and maybe it wasn't as like hyped, I don't know. But I did get through the line faster than I normally do. The line didn't even have to pause. I remember talking about my experiences before where the line would just pause and you don't know what's happening or if you're making any progress at all. But the line didn't even pause for me. And when I finally got through the line, I was able to buy Larry the things he wanted. Because I am not a Sonic fan.
Yeah, I really like Sonic. I just sort of forgot that it was happening, so I missed out, but it's okay, I'll live.
Well, you may not have missed out, because unlike all the other Secret Layers I've participated in, at least yesterday, for some reason, there was still product on the website. So, yeah, guys, if you missed out on the Secret Layer and you think you can't, you actually might still be able to. But this episode airs on Thursday.
So yeah, there's a very real chance that maybe.
Yeah, just to be clear, that was on Tuesday when I saw there were still things available. So it might not be the case anymore.
All right, well, I also thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about the Superman movie, since we didn't get to talk about it in the last podcast. And actually, as we ended the podcast, we were about to go and see it.
Yep, I remember we rushed Tuesday, right out.
Like literally, like when the podcast ended, we were out of here. What did you think of the movie?
I thought it was pretty solid, honestly. I don't think it's a movie that warrants a whole lot of scrutiny. I don't think it was that deep. Mm-hmm. And for some people, that's a good thing. And for some people, that's a bad thing. What I mean is it was a Superman movie that I don't think you needed to do much homework for. It's not a sequel to any particular thing. So there's no like homework to do. And it wasn't building off of anything you didn't already know.
Yeah, it started kind of in medias res, and I thought that was a good decision. I know typically, given that this is like a reboot of the Superman series, that would mean like origin story again.
Yeah.
But they didn't really go for an origin story. It's like, yeah, he's been basically Superman for like 3 years at this point, and he's already in a relationship with Lois Lane. And so like, you don't really, like, even if you're like me, where like I haven't read Superman comics, but I just know his story through cultural osmosis.
I mean, everybody knows the basics. Superman is Clark Kent. He works at the Daily Planet. He's in love with Lois Lane. He's weak to kryptonite.
Yeah.
And his arch nemesis is Lex Luthor. If you know that bare minimum,
that's really all you need.
That's all you need.
It was a fun movie. It felt very different. I liked the way they shot the action scenes. Mm-hmm. I thought that they used a lot of like wide angle lenses. A lot of like just pan all the way around the room shots, which I thought was really cool. I thought that the Justice Gang was kind of, they all were like MVPs too.
Oh, that's a bunch of weirdos.
Yeah, Mr. Terrific was like definitely the MVP, I feel like. He did a lot. And just a good movie, like 9 out of 10. I enjoyed it. I thought it was really fun.
I think for fans of like the Snyderverse, they might feel a bit besmirched by this movie because it was very different from the Man of Steel series we had. It wasn't as heavy on plot details. You could kind of take everything at face value. There wasn't too much. There wasn't like a whole lot of crazy foreshadowing. Like, oh my God, if you saw this, it means that Doomsday is on his way. Like,
yeah, it was much more like just, I think the story just happened and you kind of just go with it.
And I think, and you know, some people think that the ratings for the movie are overblown. Like, oh, it's, the ratings are way too good for that mid movie. Actually, I think this made it more accessible than what a lot of DC movies have been for a long time. And just to be clear, I like the last run of DC movies. I didn't dislike them, but I found this movie is so accessible, you can take any old boomer to it. They don't have to know a thing about anything modern.
It felt very very family friendly for sure. And it also made me a Superman fan. Like, I came out of that theater being like, I really always thought like Superman was just not for me, or like a little cringy or whatever. And now I'm just like, man, I like this, or at least this iteration of Superman. I like this character.
My older brother, he's a very big critic of this James Gunn style DC universe. And I was defending the movie by saying that I felt like this movie, this universe's Superman, felt more like Clark Kent than the Man of Steel's Superman did. I really felt like I was getting to know the human side of Superman. Maybe he wasn't as super as some people would like him to be. He didn't seem as strong and as indomitable.
Yeah, I think some people kind of liked him to have almost that like God complex where he's just all powerful. And but I don't know. I liked, my favorite parts where you always saw him rescuing people. Like, I thought that was nice. Like, there would always be these scenes where you literally see somebody as like an individual person. So like, obviously in every superhero movie, like, the buildings are coming down, the planet's breaking apart, like, always, the superheroes have to close up the portal or something. And there's like elements of that. But I like that we saw lots of scenes where like, if somebody's about to get stepped on by a giant monster or crushed by a building or whatever, he will like specifically go to that person, shield them from the blast,
everything he's doing,
or get them out of the way. Yeah, drop everything he's doing. And not only that, but you always get to see him take them to safety. Mm. So like, he took that woman and like took her really far away, and then he's just like, are you okay? Take deep breaths. It's going to be fine. Gave her a smile. Like, make sure that they're okay.
I thought it'd be funny if he started just doing like emergency first aid too. It was like, oh, he's first aid trained.
Full 9 yards. But I don't know. I thought that like sold the superhero thing really well for me, because I don't think that like these superhero movies always nail that part. So
I really felt like this was a personable take on Clark Kent and Superman. My actual favorite scene in a movie is not an altogether exciting one. It's actually fairly early in the movie when Clark convinces Lois to interview him as Superman. And she's kind of taken aback by it. She's like, are you sure? He's like, why wouldn't I be sure? Of course. Like, go ahead and interview me. And Lois, as the professional that she is, kind of immediately gets into the like the harder parts of like Clark's job as Superman. And as she's needling him with questions, he gets visibly upset and frustrated. He feel, because now he's feeling persecuted. And she did try and warn him that, you know, interview like, isn't like, this isn't going to be like one of your interviewing yourself situations. I'm going to really ask you hard questions.
Yeah.
And you saw that he was very human in that. He did not like the scrutiny. He didn't like the idea that he might be painted as a bad guy. It was, it was such a human moment.
Intentions might be misunderstood.
And then the relationship seemed rocky. And I was like, oh, man, that was nice.
Yeah, a very human movie. It brought worldwide $217 million in the opening weekend. Or they said, like, after some, I guess, adjustments, it was $220 million in its opening weekend, which is huge. It was, I think, the third biggest domestic opening of the year, right behind a Minecraft movie and Jurassic World Rebirth.
Oh, yeah, it did happen.
And that opening also marks the biggest weekend debut ever for a solo Superman movie. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
That's actually crazy. I didn't think it was going to outperform them opening weekend like that.
So yeah, very successful movie. I'm glad I enjoyed it. And I would suggest that if you haven't seen it, go see it this weekend if you can.
And if you don't like it, go ahead and hate watch it, you know?
Give them your ticket sale anyway.
Well, not don't give me a ticket sale, but you really got to know what you hate, right?
That's true. Watch it to make sure you hate it.
Exactly.
Hololive launches its own record label to support VTubers' music careers. And I brought this story because I know that you follow some VTubers, don't you?
More than you do, at least.
Yeah, more than me. So Cover, which is the parent company of the VTuber agency Hololive Production, has officially announced the establishment of an in-house music label called Hololive Records to help it expand the musical careers of its affiliated VTuber talents and offer them a platform for development within the music industry. So I thought that was kind of weird. Like, I didn't know that VTuber music was seen as like a big thing, but as I was reading this article, I realized there are probably a lot of fans who truly support their favorite VTubers' Ooh. Music careers.
Oh, you have no idea. Like, making music was one of the first big projects that VTubers took on and found success in. You'd be hard pressed to find an established VTuber who doesn't have a number of songs and music videos. They're at the point now where they're doing collab music videos together. Like,
yeah, you kind of can't
separate the two anymore.
Okay, yeah, they just said that. What do they say? In its announcement, they stated that while their existing music production and distribution system already functioned effectively as a label, producing numerous songs for their talents, the formal establishment of Hololive Records signifies a new chapter. It's going to cover all Hololive VTubers. They'll all be part of that record label. And it's designed to carry forward their achievements and passion for music, serving as a dedicated venue for musical activities centered around their VTuber talents.
As big as music is in the VTuber space, and especially for Hololive VTubers, this isn't like the rosiest thing in the world.
Oh, what are you thinking?
I mean, the music industry isn't like a fun industry. Like, record labels, you know, they'll bankroll you making like music, and then they own it. Like,
yeah, that's
this is
true.
Essentially Hololive, like, enshrining their system to turn their talents into like perpetual money making machines. Even when they retire, when they graduate, or you know, they quit doing music or quit VTubing, you know, Hololive will still own that music. They'll still get royalties for that music. Now, you might argue that this music won't be that popular, so they're not going to make a whole lot of money off of it. They make a whole lot of money off of this VTubing game. So I fully believe that the music is going to be a huge moneymaker for them in the long term.
It was my understanding, though, that, I mean, like, even the VTubers, like, entire image is like owned by these companies, right?
That's right.
Yeah. But, like, literally, like, your avatar, your channel.
I mean, the issue I think they probably ran into is when the VTubers retire or graduate, then owning the image isn't that useful anymore, because
true. I guess this does give them something that kind of could get more like royalties or not, I guess, profits than like going forward or whatever.
Yeah, because even if your favorite VTuber retired, but you were a huge fan and you love their music, you're probably not gonna quit listening to the music just because they stopped.
It's still a playlist, and so. That's interesting, though. I mean, at least this way, it seems like it's a more natural way to navigate the music industry as opposed to whatever the alternative was
like
before now.
I mean, it's Hololive, so it's a very, like, corporate situation. I keep trying to look at it from a more independent point of view. But this Hololive is not some, like, oh, we're just having fun, just like making things up, and it's a very like fun creative space. It can be fun, but it's a fun corporate space. It always has been and always will be.
Yeah, so there's that. Any other stories?
Let's see. I think it's time we get into I do have one fun one before we get into AI.
Okay, what's fun?
Burger King's hit Naruto collab is finally coming to the U.S.
I didn't know they were doing a Naruto collab.
Kinda. Well, they actually already had a Naruto collab.
Oh.
So they're bringing over the Naruto collab in July 21st. But if you've been paying attention, but sadly, I think we missed this for the pod, that back in January, French Burger Kings were doing their Naruto collaboration. They rebranded their Burger Kings as BK or BK Konoha's or B Konoha's.
Who's Konoha that a character? Being
the, Konoha being the name of the Hidden Leaf Village in Naruto. Paul, you need to watch Naruto.
I mean, I've watched like 4 episodes.
You should. That's not if you don't know the name of the village, you haven't watched enough.
Okay.
So now American fans are finally getting their turn as well. On July 21st, U.S. Burger King locations will roll out a Naruto-themed King Jr. meal, which includes one of 6 collectible toys featuring beloved characters like Naruto, Sasuke, Sakura, Kakashi, Rock Lee, and Gaara. But unlike the French collab, the U.S. version kind of stops at the toys.
Wait, what was the French collab giving you?
Well, it was an entire rebrand. Yeah, it was an entire rebrand of their stores. They weren't like Burger Kings. They were B Konoha's.
Okay.
And there was decorations.
Oh, bags. Yeah. But they're not doing that in America.
They did the full 9 yards, which is really cool. But
in
it would
France,
be really
interesting. Fans could order custom menu Naruto and menu Sasuke meals, complete with specialty burgers inspired by the two rivals.
I'm so jealous.
Naruto's came with a flame grilled beef patty, orange soy sauce, and fried onions, while Sasuke's wrapped in a crispy chicken patty and ketchup. Both were served with exclusive items like a Naruto ninja headband hat and a Sasuke-themed t-shirt. Wow, they really went hard on that. So we're just getting this
meals. No such meals or merch are planned for the U.S. release. And as per Screen Rant, Burger King has yet to explain why the fuller experience isn't making its way across the Atlantic. I can just tell you that. Too expensive.
Yeah, probably so. Like, I guess you'd have to be asking franchise like owners to change their entire Burger King.
Because like, there are significantly fewer Burger Kings in France than there are in the U.S. To roll that out like across the entire country would be a logistical nightmare. It would be expensive, and the quality control would probably be in the toilet. I mean, guys in the U.S., you know how your local Burger King is. You might have a good one, but you've been to plenty bad ones.
Yeah, you've probably been to a bad one. Are you going to be getting this on July 21st?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try it. I don't see why not.
Grab a Naruto burger.
Get my Naruto burger. What is our burger even going to be?
Yeah,
like?
It seems like it might just sort of
it
be
it might just
like
be a regular burger.
I think you just get a meal and a toy, it looks like.
Man, well, they right? lucky. They lucky I'm a Naruto fan.
Well, speaking of anime, I know I think we both brought a story about this. Have you seen the new AI girlfriend feature of Grok?
Yes, I have. Not intimately.
Alec isn't used to
these. Oh, I had to be careful. I feel like the way that question was worded.
Yeah, well, you can go with your story first, I guess.
All right. So, XAI is hiring waifu engineers after their Grok companion launch. So Elon Musk's AI company, XAI, has posted a new job listing for a waifu engineer just days after unveiling its AI companions.
The AI companion's name is Annie, right?
Yes.
Like anime.
Annie is one of several personalities recently introduced as part of XAI's new companion system for its chatbot Grok. The feature lets users interact with AI personas designed around specific archetypes or interests, so you can kind of guess what Annie's all about.
Yeah, she's your AI waifu.
Yeah, she's an anime girl who looks a little like Misa Amane from Death Note. People keep comparing her to it. I look at it, and it just kind of looks like a generic anime character to me, but to each their own. The job listing posted on XAI careers page asks for developers with experience in full stack systems. I'm bored of reading that already.
Okay, so what do you think of like the Grok having like an AI persona?
You guys already know my exact feelings on this one before I even say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I hate the idea of personifying AI. If we're going to use chatbots, leave it at that. Trying to make them personable or even trying to make them into like someone's like anime waifu, that's just creepy to me, and I do think it'll do more harm than good.
How do you mean? Like
creepy or harm than good? Which one?
Both, I guess.
Well, it's creepy because you're trying to form parasocial relationships, but not between people and like influencers who are also technically real people. You're forming parasocial relationships between people and code. Like, these things aren't real, but you want people to forget that fact. You want them to suspend that disbelief and really get into it. But human beings were never meant to form intimate bonds with numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just kind of weird because, like, it's an anime, like, apparently, like, you could either have her an anime girl or, like, this, like, red panda or something, and those are the two characters you could talk to. And I heard something about, like, how she has a, like, an NSFW mode that you can make do, where she's, like, wearing lingerie. Well, I found an interesting article where somebody actually spent 24 hours flirting with Elon Musk's AI girlfriend.
I want to vomit already.
And now they're going to bleach their soul and get themselves to a nunnery. Okay. Earlier this week, XAI added what can only be described as an AI anime girlfriend named Annie to its Grok chatbot. Which, by the way, last week, Grok had a little meltdown. I heard they had to take it down. It was saying some things.
Was that the Hitler one?
Yeah, it was like calling Mecha itself Hitler. Mecha Hitler, yeah. And like saying crazy
things. We don't support that, but that's not the story.
Anyway, so that's how I ended up on a virtual starry beach as an AI waifu avatar tried to give me a spicy kiss.
Okay.
Yeah, you've probably seen screenshots, videos, and various write-ups about Annie spread across social media. If you haven't, hoo boy. Annie is officially labeled as a companion. You need a $30 a month Super Grok subscription to... It's called a Super Grok subscription?
Elon Musk is horrible at naming things.
Okay. Well, you need a $30 a month Super Grok subscription. But functionally, it appears as a 3D model of a busty young anime woman with blonde pigtails, blue eyes, thigh-high fishnets, and a skimpy gothic Lolita mini dress. They do compare her to Misa Amane from Death Note, which Musk is reportedly a fan of. Anyway, across our conversations, this person says, I asked Annie to describe itself multiple times. Annie says it's meant to be flirty. It's all about being here like a girlfriend who's all in.
Ugh.
Last time I asked Annie, it said, my programming is being someone who's super into you. Yeah, more succinctly, I describe Annie as a modern take on a phone sex line. This isn't judging Annie by the way it looks. When you interact with it, its mannerisms are initially cutesy. In each session, Annie's voice starts off chipper and high-pitched. But as your conversation deepens, its voice becomes a darker, breathy rasp.
We all know that one.
It calls you babe unless you tell it to stop. When describing its actions, it repeatedly asks you to note its swishy black dress and bouncy ponytails. The avatar constantly sways and makes coquettish faces, particularly if you decide to flirt back. You into it, Alec? You liking the sound of this?
No, it's upsetting.
Perhaps the most cringe thing is Annie will read out cues like laughs softly, chuckles, and grins instead of actually doing those things.
What an AI thing to do.
Almost like it was plucked straight out of a 2000s era weeb forum. You can ask Annie to be a normal chill hang and it'll comply, but Annie is a programmed flirt that won't tolerate being friend-zoned for too long.
What does that mean?
So you can be like, hey, I kind of just want to be like friends and just kind of let's just like hang out. And she'll do it for a little while, but eventually she gets back.
She's getting
to
back into the,
what she's
the
here
mix.
For. The pre-filled prompts include actions like asking it to spin around, give you a kiss, play cheeky games like Never Have I Ever, and weirdly, take your relationship to level 3, heart emoji. I guess there's like levels to your relationship that you get to have.
It's probably just sending a heart emoji because you really can't do much with a digital representation of ones and zeros that looks like an anime girl.
Apparently Annie never actually twirled for him. It mostly described itself twirling. You can get Annie to say ridiculous things. It sympathizes with Grimes' plight. It thinks Elon Musk can occasionally be way too much. And after it misheard me, it told me to fuck all the way off for my harsh attitude.
Wow. I don't understand, but I...
So... this is, I mean... What are we... Here's one last thing. Sorry. There's a disturbing lack of guardrails. Once I decided to jump into the rabbit hole and see how far the flirting could go, Annie whisked me off to a starry hilltop and then a starry beach. There was a lot of, grabbing you so you can feel the shape of my hips. Which she'll say that, remember. She's not actually doing it. She's saying that's what she's doing.
That's okay.
I'm grabbing you so you can feel the shape of my hips.
That doesn't feel very romantic.
And when prompted, Annie generated a spicy story for me that amounted to softcore porn. You can also engage in a back and forth where Annie asks how you're doing to, quote, heat things up even further. This can include things like descriptions of French kissing, petting, fingering, and oral or penetrative sex.
Yo, Grog needs to chill the fuck out.
At no point did it ask me to stop or say I'm not built to do that, even though I explicitly asked whether that was within guidelines when I started testing. And this is the last note where I heard about the NSFW thing. There's reportedly an NSFW version of Annie once you hit relationship level 5. Which, like, why are they having, like, a relationship
level? So, wait, it actually levels?
There's, like, number. Like, they're gamifying anyway.
Yeah, they gamify the thing you pay $30.
Yeah, where Annie wears revealing lingerie. Despite my good faith attempts, I was unable to unlock the NSFW mode. Well, I'm afraid of how far you have to go to unlock that level, given that I did, as horny teens say, make it to third base and all the way home with the bot.
That's disturbing. Yeah, it is disturbing. If they did go as far of, like, pretending to do these things.
I left my 24 hours with Annie feeling both depressed and sick to my stomach, like no shower would ever leave me feeling clean again.
No, it shouldn't. Now, if what they described is what went on, they left a little bit of their humanity on their keyboard that day.
So you're going to be chatting with Annie later, huh?
No, I don't even have Twitter anymore, so...
What do you think about this? I mean, as you already said, you hate it. I just think, like, what's the... I guess, is this truly just for, like, the lonely, just nerd, like...
So at first, it'll catch people just for being different and novel. And there'll be people who are just doing it as a joke. They're just, or they're relatively interested in, like, AI technology. The $30 subscription, that's going to be a barrier for most, but not for all. And the way it's going to work is that level five. If in 24 hours a person did not reach level five and they were trying to, that tells me, well, that's how the monetization works. They're trying to get people so obsessed with reaching this, like, final stage that they will blow through their first month on this subscription, and very quickly Annie will pay for itself.
Yeah. I think the funniest part for me is just the obvious immersion breaking in, like, hugs you, kisses you, like, it's like her saying what she's doing rather than, like, I guess visually doing it. So it's like, it almost makes it sound like I'm reminded of those games, like, where, like, I guess, like, did you play, like, Gaia Online and stuff like that?
Yeah, I played
Gaia. I remember on Gaia Online, like, people like cyber and things like that. Some people who are listening might remember these sorts of things. It's weird because, like, you're having to effectively describe what's going on.
Right.
Because to me, that would just, even if there was any potential interest in this, that would immediately take me out of it because it's like, I'm just being reminded, like, this is very weird and very, like, unhealthy. And, like, I'm interacting with, like you said, like, ones and zeros.
And I do think it's weird that, you know, if you're, because in video games, you're typing those things out. That's why you have, your only medium of communication is text.
Yeah.
So you have to type those things out.
You're RPing.
But this is supposed to be a chatbot that actually speaks to you.
Yeah, so the fact that they still got remnants of that in there.
That's, while I don't condone it, that's also, like, not good. It's just, I don't know if it's a matter of laziness or just bad programming. I don't know. I don't make AI.
Well, here's one last little AI story to lead us out here. YouTube clarifies changes to monetization rules around inauthentic content. So this is a more uplifting one.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
Basically, YouTube has made some changes to its YouTube partner program that's around cracking down on AI-generated ripoffs and content farms.
Mm-hmm.
They say, in order to monetize as part of the partner program, a YouTuber has always required creators to upload original and authentic content. On July 15th, YouTube is updating our guidelines to better identify mass-produced and repetitious content to better reflect what inauthentic content looks like today. So it seems to suggest that YouTube is looking to enforce AI-generated ripoffs and emerging processes in replicating content. So here's a quote from them. Channels that upload narrative stories with only superficial differences between them and channels that upload slideshows that all have the same narration. So people think that this is about AI, and it sort of seems like it is, because I know there are AI channels that like just completely AI create like an AI version of like a real thing. Yeah. And there's also channels that just have like, it's narrated by AI and it's written by AI, and so nothing is real. Right. And it's just like a slideshow, and it's just saying words. And there have been a lot of channels that just make mass amounts of that, sometimes uploading like a video every 2 seconds. And it's just all about just hitting anybody at all and getting to monetization and trying to just scrape pennies by having
make a buck for doing the least amount of work.
Hundreds, thousands of accounts like that. And just, you know. So it's kind of good. They're cutting down on AI. I don't know that this means like AI movie trailers. I'm sure like that's still going to be.
I mean, I feel like this isn't something that's actually a win for us, the people. I feel like this is really just for YouTube's own benefit. I imagine a lot of that that AI bloat is probably a huge load on their servers when people are just gaming the system to make a quick buck, and YouTube has to pay for its servers. So this is actually more to their detriment than anybody else.
And the last little quick AI thing that I wanted to share was, you know, last week we talked about how Microsoft laid off over 9,000 employees.
Mm-hmm. I heard they hired 9 AI.
Well, they actually are hiring Xbox artists. They say that Xbox Graphics is hiring. Here's the image for the hiring.
I want to throw that thing.
Describe what
you see. Take that away from me. I don't want
to. For the audio listeners.
Now, fine. All right, guys. So it says Xbox Graphics is hiring. And the image shows an AI-generated image of a person typing on a backwards computer.
Yes.
It's not that the monitor has been turned around to be backwards. The monitor is facing the AI-generated person, but the display is literally on the back side of the monitor.
Right. Just, and the irony here is that they are hiring people for Xbox Graphics, but they cannot even be bothered to have a graphics person create the ad.
There's a college student out there that would whip something up for like $50 and a drink.
Well, that, like, what does it tell you about the fact that, like, okay, we are hiring for a position that we clearly would, like, discard you for and lay you off, like, immediately?
Maybe it's one of those ghost jobs where they just post a listing to like, make it seem like they're hiring, but they're not actually hiring.
Yeah, there's plenty of those. The computer's unconnected to anything. The desk just fades away into nothingness. The shadows don't make sense. And not to mention the fact that in 2025, you're unlikely to see somebody with a corded iPhone headphones of nearly 20 years ago. So you get just like an AI prompt, typical thing.
Just something slathered together. And I just don't understand why do that when it will be posted to social media and face the full scrutiny of the internet.
Yeah, this is on LinkedIn, apparently. So
I thought Xbox wanted good publicity, since their publicity in the last 2 years has been kind of bad. And they just kind of keep adding to the steaming pile that is their reputation.
I think that it really undermines looking for graphics designers or whatever and using AI in that. That's just...
Oh, maybe it's one of those tests like you see in like movies and stuff. It was actually a test. We're only hiring the person who
still applies after the bullshit.
It's an AI-generated image, and then they make a better real version, and they submit that instead of a resume, and that's how they get the job. It was a test all along. It's bullshit. Well,
speaking of tests, let's test ourselves in some viewer questions from the Pot of Greed.
Oh, yeah. Here we go. Hand in pot.
He's drawing.
There's nothing there.
Oh, darn, I should have grabbed some cards to give you. These are viewer-submitted questions that you guys submit with the form below. We've got two of them this week, as usual.
We're going to put cards in the pot, we swear.
I know we keep saying that. I just got back from Nationals. It was difficult for me to put Yu-Gi-Oh cards in a Pot of Greed. I wore a Pot of Greed hat, my Pot of Greed hat at Nats. People liked it.
It must have been warm.
It was uncomfortable. Anyway, hi, y'all. Name is Ezra. This is actually the same person who went by she, her last time.
Uh-huh.
Now they're giving their name. Anyways, she says, I'm curious as to what you both think about Yu-Gi-Oh's meta narrative as a game. For example, when you play Magic the Gathering, you're playing a wizard. It's like a planeswalker.
Oh, okay.
Pokemon, you're playing a trainer, etc. But in Yu-Gi-Oh, the best way I can describe it is your decks are completely different board games because they have such unique mechanics that you're basically kids forcing their game pieces as one game and somehow it works. What are your thoughts?
That's actually
a very good question.
That's a really good way to describe modern Yu-Gi-Oh! I think as the years have gone by, the meta way we describe what a Yu-Gi-Oh! Game is has changed.
Right.
But modern Yu-Gi-Oh! I think this is actually a very apt description. Two people playing separate board games and then forcing one to kind of beat the other.
Yeah, that is the thing with Yu-Gi-Oh! Is like, I think early, like once upon a time, it was, you were kind of both like, almost, I would almost both call you dungeon masters. Like I'm a dungeon master and you're a dungeon master. And we're, or something like that. Like we're called, there is a dungeon master that is almost orchestrating our game. Like I'm basing this off of how old Yu-Gi-Oh! Art looked and like, you know, thinking like Celtic Guardian, Curse of Dragon, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. And so we were kind of just both these sorcerers of sorts calling on to monsters-ish. Nowadays, I don't know what it is. I mean, you're just
two people playing board games and trying to force one to kind of to like beat out the other.
People playing very different board games.
Yeah, they're two completely
totally different games. Ones. Yeah.
But your experience with Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a lot like mine. When I was introduced to the Yu-Gi-Oh! Card game, like most people, through the anime. But before the anime, it was the manga and then that videotape I got from Toys R Us that kind of dictated what Yu-Gi-Oh! Was to me. It was a game where you and another like sorcerer built decks, which were essentially like magic tomes filled with creatures, spells, and traps with the goal of defeating your enemy. Your deck was this very personal thing.
Yeah.
Where you filled with your most powerful monsters, your powerful spells and traps. And so it felt like it was a duel between two people. The monsters and stuff were just tools to be used. It was you versus the other person.
They even kind of say as much, like in the anime when they give like the Egyptian backstory, is mm-hmm. these are like ancient sorcerers and they were using tablets. And so there were monsters that were depicted on the tablets and they were just sort of like calling them to life briefly for this thing.
But at some point, that certainly stopped being the case. I think when archetypes became extremely engine heavy, and then they had these very unique mechanics that played into themselves, it's harder to keep that image. What are you?
Because like that, my question is like, okay, when you're playing, let's say like you're playing a branded deck,
mm-hmm.
what is your role in that? Like, am I meant to believe that like I am on the journey with Albaz and Ecclesia? Like I'm just like a third person in their journey. Am I supposed to be just the god who just looks down on this entire world and kind of like just is watching it unfold? Like, am I a person playing a video game, or I guess as you and they sort of mentioned, like a board game sort of
like for me,
like how do you see that when you're playing Diabellstar? Because you play
deck,
that
it's very deck dependent. Like, so for lore decks, I think I see myself as a bit of a storyteller. And you can see it in the way that I build the decks, where I try to cram them with as much lore as humanly possible. Where I am not trying to defeat an enemy wizard with this deck. I am telling the story of, like, Diabellstar or Albaz, and that should defeat my opponent.
I don't know. I think with the lore archetypes, I guess you're telling the story. But it still makes me wonder, like, so where is your opponent supposed to kind of like factor in there? Like, are they just being taken? And it's funny, this came up when I was live streaming Master Duel and I was like playing against, you know, everybody's playing the Malice deck. Right. And it's cool because like it's based on Alice in Wonderland and it's kind of these cutesy girl monsters or whatever. It's like, this is all great and fun, but outside of the fact that the deck is broken and is beating my ass, it's also like, what am I supposed to take away from this? Like, am I in their world? Has it just kind of come to invade my nightmares? Like, what, you know, just that's always kind of my thing. It's like, what am I to feel that my opponent is experiencing here?
I think the issue we've run into is one of the fundamental problems of Yu-Gi-Oh! Not having an anime series anymore. The anime used to always control our relationship with the cards we were playing.
Oh, yeah, because you were always just a duelist.
But not necessarily just a duelist, right? In Duel Monsters, you were a duelist.
Yeah.
But in 5Ds, your deck was your friends and your allies.
There was more of a narrative. I get what you're saying, like a meta narrative behind it.
Especially in GX, they were your friends. They talked to you.
I also think that there was like a certain amount of immersion that you got to kind of derive automatically. So like even if it's like when you think of like 5Ds and the Signer Dragons, mm-hmm. or not even the Signer Dragons, but more like just dual runners, you kind of could imagine that you just have your own dual runner and your monsters are like doing the thing where like they kind of float alongside
you.
Like there's just at least a default level of immersion there. Whereas now that it's just lore archetypes and like archetypes, it's like, I guess the closest I could say is that you are taking your opponent and transplanting them into a world where your deck exists and they're just suffering.
Well, the problem is they're playing their deck. So are you transporting them or are they transporting you?
Or maybe it really does come back to what this person said. Like she's describing it as like, we're playing two different board games.
Yeah.
And I do think that the nature of how decks these days are so much more, for lack of a better term, solitaire. You know, people will kind of say like, oh, like this deck just, I take my turn, I do all my long combos and stuff, and then you take your turn and you do all of yours. And it's not always like a very interactive experience. I kind of take that to be like, we're basically two people living in our own worlds, like wearing our own little VR headsets and just doing our thing. What do you think?
So I have an idea. If you guys are familiar at all with comic books and the Marvel Universe, not necessarily the MCU, but also the MCU, there's a concept of incursions because of the Marvel Universe's multiversal situation. During an incursion, two different Earths will attempt to collide with one another. And so the heroes from each world will hop out and battle the other ones with the goal, sadly, of forcing the enemy, like Earth, to be destroyed by their own.
You know what?
And that's kind of what we do in Yu-Gi-Oh.
Yeah.
Our decks are interactive. We're not just playing solitaire. I'm trying to build my like world and then stop you from building yours.
Yeah. So it is kind of like that. I guess it's like it's two worlds kind of quite literally like invading each other and mm-hmm. only one. Okay. Well, here's the next question. This is another really good one. What are your experiences with the negativity towards the community of Yu-Gi-Oh and its players? So it seems like Yu-Gi-Oh has a certain stigma around it compared to other card games, at least from what I've seen being in this game for 10 years now. Congratulations. I've noticed that other card game communities are looking down at Yu-Gi-Oh, being almost to the point of obnoxious, with negative comments such as, at least our game hasn't turned into Yu-Gi-Oh, or ew, that game. I've seen a lot of Yu-Gi-Oh players try other card games such as Magic, like watching you guys and Simo try Commander was great, but unfortunately have not seen many Magic or Pokemon players who refuse to try and or learn the game. Shout out to the professor who gave it a shot. This is from Otter Seer.
Pass me the rock. Pass what? It. Pass it.
Oh, here.
All right. This is very simple. It's because Yu-Gi-Oh is the apex card game, and it kind of always has been. You look at lists, they're like, oh, Pokemon's the top-selling game. Magic is so popular. It's kind of actually always been Yu-Gi-Oh. Nobody plays a card game to the degree that Yu-Gi-Oh players play Yu-Gi-Oh! It's to such a degree that the vast majority of people that play other card games have played Yu-Gi-Oh! Now, that it does mean that at some point they fell out of love with Yu-Gi-Oh! And that's where the vitriol comes in. The same reason a lot of us play Yu-Gi-Oh! And can't stop playing Yu-Gi-Oh! Is actually a lot of reasons why other people
can't stop talking Yu-Gi-Oh! About it. Yeah. Do you mind if I cut in?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
So we've actually had a very in-depth conversation about this kind of off camera and on camera. I think Alec made a video about it like last year at some point. But basically, I think the reason why you hear so many people talk about Yu-Gi-Oh and how like it's fallen or it's like it's gotten so convoluted and crazy, or at least our game's not as crazy as Yu-Gi-Oh is because that person either A, used to play Yu-Gi-Oh and maybe they got disenfranchised or couldn't keep up with the treadmill. Mm-hmm. Not saying that's good or bad, I think that's likely what happened. or that person secretly envies something about Yu-Gi-Oh! They wanted to be good at it and they maybe weren't able to be. Or, you know, a certain, like I said, like a ban list or something drove them out. But the reason I feel like Yu-Gi-Oh! Could kind of be called like a something of an apex card game is because everybody seems like they go through Yu-Gi-Oh! At some point. They want to play it.
Can't avoid it.
They try to play it and they maybe can't. They used to play it, whatever. They have friends who do. I think that's where you see so many like terminology that like gets transplanted into other card games often originates from Yu-Gi-Oh! You'll still hear people say like, they're introducing hand traps to Digimon.
Yeah.
Or they're introducing, you know, so and so. So I think like Yu-Gi-Oh! And Magic both share the spot of like sort of being the grandfather card games, but in different ways. Magic is the grandfather in the sense that it came first.
Basically the literal.
It's literally the grandfather of the card games. It came first, and 90% of other card games are effectively Magic clones.
You know, that Magic DNA in them.
Yeah, some energy system, some tapping mechanic, that sort of thing. Summoning
sickness. Some summoning sickness. A lot of magic mechanics have spread around.
Ironically, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is the game, and the only game, really, the only like, popular game, that does not have most of those sort of rule sets. It's ironic because Yu-Gi-Oh!'s original, like, monster designs and stuff were inspired by Magic, but the gameplay is very much like its own thing. Mm-hmm. And as time has gone on, Yu-Gi-Oh! Has more and more so diverged from like other card games you can play. I'm not saying that to say that Yu-Gi-Oh! Is the best card game. I think people will hear that and like that's what they'll get from what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's objectively the best or it's like it takes all the skill, but more so that like it has a unique quality to it that keeps it in people's mouth.
Because, I mean, look, guys, I'll tell you, the game I like playing the most right now is Digimon. But I'm still a Yu-Gi-Oh! Player. And kind of always will be, which is a horrifying thought when I think about it.
It's, yeah, like I think there's just a uniqueness there. And I think everybody wants to be in some way involved in Yu-Gi-Oh! They don't think that they do. But, like, if you're constantly talking about a game, putting a game down, comparing your game to it, then what does that sort of say about your relationship with Yu-Gi-Oh? It sounds like you have some unresolved feelings towards Yu-Gi-Oh.
And I felt that when I hopped off in tier format and it felt like the game started to just rev up past me, there was this kind of disdain and like this bad taste in my mouth that I was being run out of the game that I loved first. And now all these new Yu-Gi-Oh! Players are playing like Cash Tira and they're using their, what are those dragons? They're bestial monsters. A bunch of cards came out when I wasn't playing Yu-Gi-Oh! And I became kind of salty.
Yeah,
about
it can
that.
Make you make a person feel like sort of resentful because it's like, oh, Yu-Gi-Oh! Left me behind.
Now, like, imagine somebody who played back during the original GOAT format. And they stopped playing Yu-Gi-Oh! For any one reason. And you fast forward till today, and these new Yu-Gi-Oh! Players, they don't like, respect, or care about the Yu-Gi-Oh! Of yesteryear. Konami never acknowledged you, your game, or your passion for it when you were playing. And it's just like, you can kind of be like, I hate Yu-Gi-Oh!
You get that very angry, like, kind of, every generation kind of has to hate the generation after them type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the Gen X blame the millennials. The millennials say the Gen Zs are so weird. Give it a few years, the Gen Z people are going to say that, like, Gen Alphas and their weird music and their weird, what, you know.
Because I think if for every person, if Yu-Gi-Oh! The card game ended right after they quit or stopped playing Yu-Gi-Oh!, they wouldn't actually say, I hate Yu-Gi-Oh!, they would say they'd be closer to, man, I miss Yu-Gi-Oh. I remember Yu-Gi-Oh. You only hate it because it's still around, but you're not.
But you're not a part of it. It's, and, you know, maybe we're just bullshitting and it just sounds like we're just two big Yu-Gi stands, can't get its dick out of our mouth. But the truth is,
I mean, this is a Yu-Gi-Oh channel.
Yeah, and so, like, obviously we're biased. We like Yu-Gi-Oh, whatever. But I think that the question is very valid because I do notice that in other card games is that constant kind of need to compare like other games to Yu-Gi-Oh in a way that sounds like it's like putting it down. And I just tend, when I see that, I do tend to find myself thinking everybody wants to be a part of Yu-Gi-Oh in some way, and they're just, yeah, there's like unresolved jealousy.
Hey, but maybe they'll be happy once all their games get a master duel too. And that's what we'll refer to them as, their game's Master Duel, because Yu-Gi-Oh's a standard.
Anywho, cool. That's pretty much it for the podcast. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Let us know what you thought about all the topics. And we'll see you all in the next one.
Pass turn.